Someone else who's been inspired by the paintings in Chauvet is the novelist Kim Stanley Robinson. One of his most recent books is called Shaman. It's the story of a boy who's being groomed to become the spiritual leader of his clan 30,000 years ago. The book grew out of Robinson's kind of obsessive curiosity about our Stone Age ancestors, about their connection to the land, their spiritual beliefs, not to mention their encounters with their neighbors, the Neanderthals. Steve Paulson recently sat down with Robinson to find out why he's so interested in prehistory.
Stan, you are best known for your futuristic novels involving space travel, so your novel Shaman has surprised a lot of people since it's set in the Paleolithic period about 30,000 years ago. Is there a connection between this story and your science fiction?
Well, there kind of is. As a science fiction writer, the whole project seems to me to be fundamentally about what can human beings become in the future? Well, when you ask that question, then you have to immediately ask, well, what are we? And then when you ask, what are we, you get into the problem of how did we become what we are? And that leads you to sociobiology and a vision of our evolutionary past. And I've always been interested, because of my backpacking and because of this discovery of the Iceman in the early 90s, frozen in a glacier between Italy and Austria with all of his gear. And his gear was just like my backpacking gear, except it was different materials. And so I had this very strong sense of that they were like us. And so I was interested in telling their stories, and then the discovery of the Chauvet Cave threw the whole community into disarray. The archaeologists suddenly realized that 32,000 years ago, the artwork was just as fine. Lascaux is 17,000 years old, so the notion that we started primitive and got better and better at things was at least pushed way, way back.
I did get a chance to visit a couple of the painted caves in southwest France a couple of years ago. And the thing that is astonishing is the level of artistry there. I mean, not all of it, but some of it. I mean, if there's one thing that cuts across this chasm of time, it's that. They couldn't have been that different from us.
Yes. Well, now we know so much more. We know that genetically they weren't even the slightest bit different than us, except they might not have had lactose tolerance. Other than that, it's our genetic code exactly. So it's us. And I would propose to you that they were also high-tech. The technology that they didn't have that made them the most different from us is they didn't have writing. So everything was transmitted orally. And when I understood that, I was even more amazed. How did they keep a stable culture generation in, generation out for thousands of years when they were just telling each other stories? There was nothing written down. Well, maybe that's the secret. Maybe telling stabilized a culture. I don't know. I never solved that mystery. But it did completely change the writing of this book. I suddenly realized this is somebody talking. This is not writing. This is talking.
So your book, Shaman, is the story of this boy on the cusp of manhood, Loon, who is being groomed to be his pack's next shaman. And he goes off on what you call a wander. What is that?
Well, I took that from the Aboriginal walkabout. So that the first people's cultures in Australia had the habit of young men, when they reached their initiation rite, essentially their bar mitzvah, would be sent out for a period of time to live alone in the wilderness as a test of survival, but also a chance of reordering their mind when they come back, they're an adult.
And to set this up, it's still kind of winterish. He is stripped naked.
Yeah.
And he's got to survive. Yeah. And right away, he's got to find a way to get warm. He's got to fend off lions and bears. Quite a task.
Well, yes, extremely dangerous when there's big things, predators like lions. And not just lions, but cave lions, which were like half again as big as our lions.
Now, there is another kind of encounter that Loon has in this wander. He comes across a few Neanderthals.
Yes.
Who hunt him. You have a great passage early in the book where you describe that first encounter. Could you read that?
Yes. A sniff gave him the answer he most feared, a waft of smoke and grease almost like his own smell, but different. Old ones. They smelled different than people. Thorne had forced this knowledge on him once when they had come upon a dead old one lying in one of the shallow cliffs downstream in the gorge. Thorne had grabbed the dead one's bearskin cape and held the collar of it to Loon's nose. Lunkheads always smell like this, Thorne had said, flicking him hard on the ear. Now Loon was sweating from his face and palms. The day had suddenly become one of his nightmares. Stories about boys on their wanders being eaten by old ones had always seemed just like stories. All the men Loon knew had come back from their wanders. And if you ran into an old one, they always seemed about as harmless as any woodsman. But woodsmen could be dangerous. And the old ones were burly people, as strong as bears or wolverines. One of Thorne's stories told how an old one had married a bear by mistake, and neither of them had noticed. They definitely knew how to hunt. Their spears were stout, made for thrusting and short throws. They were experts at ambush. That was their way. When they were in pairs or trios, one would sneak around while the other watched from a blind. They hid better than any other animals, even humans.
So we know that there was a period of at least a few thousand years when humans and Neanderthals coexisted in Europe.
Yes.
It's been a huge amount of speculation about how they got along. How do you imagine this relationship between humans and Neanderthals?
Well, it was long and complex because it was actually many thousands of years probably because the Neanderthals were in Europe already, well established when the humans arrived. And so we're talking a coexistence of the two in the same landscape for maybe 20,000 years. And we throw these numbers around, but 20,000 years is a long time. Mm-hmm. And the great prehistoric novel, I would say, is The Inheritors by William Golding, in which Homo sapiens is seen as these murderous, incomprehensible killers that come into a very simple-minded species of Neanderthal. And so he wrote it from the Neanderthal point of view. And it is another Golding extraordinary achievement. What a wonderful writer, brilliantly good at evoking strangeness. So I'm glad I didn't write a Neanderthal novel because it's really already been done.
Do you sort of accept that scenario that humans are kind of the killers and Neanderthals were
perhaps
a little more innocent?
No, it's just speculative, but there's nothing that can disprove it. I mean, even now that we've learned that, something like 2 to 5% of our DNA is Neanderthal DNA, so there was sex going on between the two species that actually had offspring that was viable. We know this because we can read it right off of our own DNA. So in other words, it's such a complicated picture that it supports my idea that most of these archaeological statements are science fictions. You take a tiny bit of data, and it's a history that you can never know, and then you write a story about it, and then you can either say, well, this is my theory, or you can say this is my novel. But it just probably depends what genre you write it in, whether it's an article or whether it's a story. But it's always a story that you tell that you make up from a limited amount of data.
And one of the things that's so striking about your novel, Shaman, is there is the whole shamanic tradition as well of getting in touch with some other reality. I mean, your young character, Loon, as part of his wander early on, he ingests some mushrooms that obviously have some mind-altering effect. He sees some terrifying creature that has the head of a lion, horns. Mm-hmm. What do we make of that?
Well, you see in the shamanic tradition, I mean, mostly in South America, but really everywhere, this idea that you get outside yourself, you do something, and it could just be staying up all night and or dancing, music, drum beats, sleep deprivation, flailing yourself, running for super long distances, etc., where you get into an altered mental state, and including various plants, artemisia and various psychotropic plants. And the evidence comes out of not just the shaman cultures that are still alive today where you see people still doing it, but also on the cave walls, the abstract patterns that are sort of in the entryways, like they're the beginning of the trip. And they're also the abstract patterns that it is claimed by some scientists, and I can't swear to this personally, are exactly what everybody would see when they are coming onto certain psychotropic drugs. I'm interested. I was a California hippie. You know, I discovered the Sierra Nevada, Buddhism, science fiction, poetry, and psychedelics all at the same time. And so I've never come back from that moment. It was a permanent changer of my reality when I was, say, 20 years old, and I think all to the good, basically.
So you've had what we would call mystical experiences.
Well, I wonder. I guess so. I've had religious experiences. I've had a sense of the sacred. I've had the very strong feeling that I'm wandering in a sacred landscape and that I am part of it. And so if you call that a mystical experience, yes. And not only that, but that does not need psychotropic drugs to achieve. You just go up there in the winter in the Sierra Nevada and start walking around and start hiking hard. And at a certain point, it comes down on you, and essentially it's a space you go into that can last for days. That's the real finding, and this is more Zen than it is hippie psychedelia. This, the idea that once you're paying attention to a landscape that you're in an altered state of consciousness. Suddenly an hour is like a week, or it's very hard to characterize what an hour is, because maybe it passes and it feels like a second, but it also feels like a week. You lose that sense of normal clock time. This is a very valuable mental space.
That's Kim Stanley Robinson talking with Steve Paulson about his novel, Shaman.